This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you everybody for tuning in today. It's one of those beautiful days with a topic that is often difficult to discuss, but that's what we do here. We talk about fun topics, funny topics, and difficult topics. Let's break in all of our guests, if I push the right buttons and be able to make that happen. We have Jalen Windsor. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Jalen is a student at Lynchburg College. Thank you for driving up.
No, thank you very much for having me.
We also have in the room Claire Kaplan. Claire is director of the Gender, Violence, and Social Change Program at UVA's Women's Center.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
And then tucked over in the corner, we have Emily Renda, Program Coordinator at UVA Student Services, also recently named to be on Governor McAuliffe's Sexual Assault Task Force.
Good morning.
Going to crank all that up a little bit. So one more time, hello across the room.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Mallory, can we come in and adjust Jalen's microphone a little bit? It is a little too high up in the air. We want it more directly at her face. Because that's what happens when you come in here and you have to be on the radio. You have to, what I always say is, lower your aura. Because that microphone is stuck right there in your face. So, again, campus sexual assault is our topic for the day with Emily Renda, Claire Kaplan, and Jalen Windsor. This is 91.9 in Harrisonburg's 95.1. Stick with us throughout the hour because this is one of those really important conversations. You know, one of the things that the topic itself, sexual assault, and then you take a slice of that pie and talk about sexual assault on the campus of universities and colleges throughout the United States of America, and then you take even smaller slice of the pie and talk about some what is not a small number. Doing my research, I read 85 and somewhere else was 68 of the colleges that are under suspicion is not the right word, under investigation by the United States Department of Education for concerns about how those particular schools do their investigation about sexual assault on campus. William & Mary, James Madison University, University of Richmond, and the University of Virginia, the four that are listed in this grouping. Can anyone who wants to start with this? Emily, you're on the task force. Has the task force had a meeting yet?
Yes, we had our first meeting on October 9th, so two Thursdays ago, I suppose.
So do you talk about the topic in general, or did you talk about the fact that you have that there are four schools within our state that Governor McAuliffe put the task force together?
So I think we talk a little bit more about the topic in general and solutions and kind of strategies more in general. As far as the investigations go, it's also important to note that one of the really wonderful things that the Office of Civil Rights, who heads up these investigations, does is that each one of these investigations occurs because a student or a group of students at a college or university filed a complaint. And the complaint itself doesn't necessarily mean that there was a violation of Title IX, but the Office of Civil Rights will come in and investigate anyway. And so that's why you see these incredibly high numbers of schools on the list, because many students are reaching out to kind of have their colleges reviewed to say, you know, I don't feel that justice was served. I want to make sure that it really was. And so the Office of Civil Rights comes in to do that. And it, in many ways, is a really beneficial process where the Office of Civil Rights reviews your school's policies and procedures to be able to say, you know, fine, if not actually out of compliance with the law, here are the things that you're not doing quite correctly that you could perhaps improve upon.
What does Title IX have to do with this? Because I think for many people, at least for those of us who are sports fans, Title IX meant that you had to take money away from the men's tennis team and give it to the women's soccer team.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the 1972 higher education law that really just meant that there could be no discrimination in any educational program on the basis of sex. And that was really, you know, sports was the first kind of iteration of implementing that law. And slowly over time, it became more and more apparent that sexual harassment was a discriminatory behavior that occurred in an educational setting on college campuses that was preventing women in particular from engaging with their education fully. And so, you know, Title IX was used to then protect women from sexual assault, and that was then extrapolated to say sexual violence is really a form of sex discrimination, and so that's why colleges have to respond.
Claire Kaplan from UVA's Women's Center. Was the Women's Center here at the university before Title IX? Title IX goes back to the early and mid-1970s, correct?
No, the Women's Center was founded in 1989.
I'm going to blurb my way through this whole hour with silly male and old male, you know, poorly structured questions and comments. Was that put together because of unfairness towards women?
The Women's Center was put together, and it was founded by Sharon Davey, who was then the director of the Women's Studies Program, because there were a whole range of issues that women faced at the University of Virginia, and it didn't just apply to students. It had to do with faculty and staff, tenure issues, the way women were treated in the classrooms, a whole range of issues, and also the lack of visibility. So part of what the Women's Center does is raise the visibility of women scholars and bring speakers. And in the early years, largely it was programmatic stuff that the center did, bringing people to speak at the university on issues around gender and women scholars that you just didn't see as much, giving students an opportunity to do work around issues of feminist activism, publishing Iris magazine. So that's how it started. We're celebrating our 25th year, actually, this year. And so the services and the programs of the center have expanded pretty dramatically. I came on board in 1991, and my program was the second formal program outside of the sort of events and scholarly work and counseling that was going on.
Now, Jalen Windsor, who is here from Lynchburg College, are you aware of any specific programs like this that exist at Lynchburg?
Well, I was actually just talking with Claire before the show, and I was not aware at first of programs that we had down there in Lynchburg. She was telling me a little bit beforehand that she had that she knows some people down there who are running Project Horizon, and I'm interested in actually looking to expand upon that in our area, because I know especially Lynchburg College, we'd be very interested in having a focal point for these organizations on campuses so that more students are aware of them and can also help and educate one another.
All right. So we know that sexual assault takes place on campuses throughout the United States. Certainly, I think if you do as I do my research for this program, it's interesting, I guess, in a negative and poor way, to find out that there are numerous colleges and universities who have not reported any sexual assaults for extended periods of time. And I think that looks to probably be statistically incorrect. So
that's a good summary.
let's talk for a minute about what is the right way. If an incident takes place, what is the right way for someone to report it?
Well, I think I would maybe, you know, and kind of push back on that idea of the right way and say that a lot of what we do in kind of direct victim services and the principle that guides a lot of what happens is about returning a sense of power and control to a survivor after an incident occurs. And so, you know, the right way really is about providing the full scope of options and providing students with a real understanding of the abilities they have to utilize all those different things. So then it becomes incumbent on police, the university, you know, various programs around the community to make sure that everyone knows, you know, you can go to the hospital and get a blind report done, for example. You can talk to the police officers, but not actually.
A blind report?
Mm-hmm. So when you go to the hospital and have an investigation done, or a perk exam, so that's kind of what's colloquially called a rape kit, you can have that done and then say, I don't really want to move forward with this right now, so I'm just going to file it as a blind kit and then not pursue any charges or investigation in the hospital, and the police will hold on to that and then kind of go through it at a different time when you're ready to report. And so it's really kind of about allowing survivors to make choices that are best for their mental health. And I think we, you know, kind of what's clearly at odds in the broader discussion about this issue right now is there's a balance between giving survivors a lot of autonomy to be able to make choices that are best for them, and then kind of that idea of the right way of there is a community safety issue at play here that we have to think about ways to balance. And so universities really have to do a lot to make sure that students are fully aware of the ways they can proceed so that we are attentive to both the needs of individuals but also the needs of the community at large.
And if I could chime in too, many survivors, and Emily alluded to this, aren't really ready to confront their perpetrator, or to deal with any kind of systems, and I use that with, you know, with quotes around it, because it's too intimidating and scary. The whole one of the functions of rape or sexual assault is to remove someone's power, and that loss of power continues after the event itself. So when people are feeling disempowered, they don't feel capable of handling what they might have been able to handle prior to that incident, and so part of what is important is that the people who are closest to that survivor is to support them in whatever decisions they make, and sometimes they're not the ones they would have made themselves. Getting a perk is important early on because the evidence, they can only collect that evidence within 72 hours after a sexual assault. The upside of a blind report is that you don't have to deal with police directly. The downside is there's other evidence that could be collected if it wasn't a blind report, and that evidence will go away. So there's ups and downs to both of those things. But you don't you don't have to report to the police. You can go through if you have a university system, which they all should have, but they don't necessarily, or if you don't feel it's something you can do. You can do that only, or you could go to the police only, or you can do both. So, and then there's a civil suit that you can always file. So there's other options as well. I personally feel that bottom line is anyone needs to feel supported, and if that means starting out with counseling, then start with counseling. Mm-hmm.
11:13 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about sexual assault on campus. Not necessarily the easiest conversation for many people to have, but one of the most important for people to discuss. Our guest today, Jaylen Windsor, she's a student at Lynchburg College. Claire Kaplan, director of the Gender Violence and Social Change Program at UVA's Women's Center. Emily Renda, recently appointed to Governor McAuliffe's Sexual Assault Task Force. Let's do this, and we'll be right back.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at t-nprinting.com.
The American Shakespeare Center, celebrating 25 years in Shakespeare in downtown Stanton. Now playing at the world's only reconstruction of Shakespeare's Blackfriars Playhouse, Macbeth, Pericles, and Edward II, plus the Comedy of Errors. AmericanShakespeareCenter.com.
You can donate your unwanted vehicle to help fuel independent music radio WNRN. All you need is the title, and we'll take care of the rest. Your car can be worth more than a dealer will give you, and your tax-deductible donation supports your radio station. To learn how your car, boat, motorcycle, or RV can help WNRN, go to WNRN.org and the vehicle donation link.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for listening to WNRN. This is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, talking about campus sexual assault. Claire Kaplan from University of Virginia's Women's Center. Jalen Windsor, student at Lynchburg College. Emily Renda recently announced as a member of Governor McAuliffe's new sexual assault task force. I asked the question about what is the right way to file the report. It was mentioned that there is no single right way to do so. But does that apply to the right way for the university or someone else to handle the case?
Well, there are certain guidelines and requirements that all institutions that receive federal funding, at the very least, are required to fulfill. And we were discussing earlier Title IX. When there is a non-sexual assault case, say a student files a complaint about sexual harassment, there is typically an office or a body at an institution that's responsible for investigating that case. And the same is true, or should be true, when it comes to a sexual assault complaint that is filed. So, and those policies should be very clear, and they should be in writing, and they should be online, and they should be easy to access and understandable. They vary from campus to campus, and they don't have to be the same, because every campus is different.
One of the things that brought this topic a little more into the limelight is that universities and colleges across the country were being accused of not handling the cases properly because they seem to be considering each case as more of a blemish on their reputation than an assault on the victim. Mm-hmm. Correct?
So it seems like kind of at the heart of that perception really lies, there's a little bit of a conflict in some senses and a delicate balance that a lot of colleges are trying to navigate, and albeit navigated very poorly in many cases, of a kind of a way in which Title IX and due process, which is one of our constitutional rights, are butting up against each other. And so a lot of colleges are really trying to figure out how to navigate. You know, you want to give the process that is due in the course of an investigation, a hearing, a process, so that an accused student is still being, you know, kind of their right to an education is protected, while also under Title IX, somebody who's been victimized also has their right to an education protected. And balancing those two things has been very difficult, which is why you see kind of under this current administration in 2011, they released a Dear Colleague letter with a lot of new guidelines about how to implement Title IX investigations, hearings, to kind of address some of those concerns about we don't know how to do these hearings because, frankly, colleges are not the criminal system. The rules are not defined the same way.
But that's not, I mean, and that's important, and I don't want to deny that, and it's something that I want to get into, mm-hmm. and it's within my notes. But am I wrong to say that colleges and universities also are being accused of just, in some way, making it a smaller case, not sometimes making the victim feel like he or she should not even bring it up, because it's not about what the criminal versus the educational concerns are, but again, the stain that goes on the university's record by even bringing it up and it's taking place.
I think that it may be true for specific institutions, but unfortunately, they've all sort of been lumped together. And if you look at individual cases, you'll see, and we only hear about the really high-profile ones. There are cases, you know, across the country going on constantly. I think that could be the perception. I think part of the issue, though, is that there has been a lack of guidance. There's been expectations on the part of the Office on Civil Rights and Department of Education on that these cases will be handled, but there's been no guidance for a long time until that Dear Colleague letter came out. And we're talking decades, you know, constantly asking for guidance, and nothing has come forward. So every institution has been left to their own devices to figure out how to handle these particular cases. Colleges and universities are handling disciplinary situations of all kinds, and sexual assault is one of those, and a particularly difficult one, because of the nature of the assaults. But there's a whole lot of other stuff they deal with constantly. And so the issue is, I think there's a question of there's a term called institutional betrayal, where someone who's been victimized, this is similar to the military, they report with the expectation that they will be supported and made to feel safe and the problem will be taken care of, which is a completely understandable expectation, and we should all have it. The question is, though, is how it's handled may not be what the survivor is expecting, and you're dealing with someone who's been traumatized. So we have someone who's grappling with trauma and wanting to be taken care of, understandably, or have the problem go away, and part of the problem is it can't go away. And so there's the issue of justice, and then there's the issue of personal trauma, and they get conflated. And then there's the other issue of what responsibility does the institution have legally. You have to separate private institutions from public. Mm-hmm. Publics are much more under the gun when it comes to due process and all the sorts of things that we hear about, those terms we hear about. Private colleges can say, we don't like you, you're out of here. You know, they can do that because they don't have to follow the same rules. So that makes it more complicated. And some private schools are under the gun, under investigation because of how they handle cases. So it's a lot more nuanced and complicated than most people realize. And then you have the issue of when you have a hearing process, the actual minutia of how that process happens can be very, very difficult for a survivor to go through. And how it happens, how they feel supported, who's asking the questions, how is it decided? What are the sanctions issues? All those things vary from school to school. So to say they're all trying to sweep it under the rug or make themselves look better is really not true, I think. I think it's true in individual cases, but very most of the time not
Let
true.
Let me ask Jalen a quick question. Jalen, are you, as a student at Lynchburg College, are you aware of any sexual assault cases that have taken place on your campus?
I'm not aware of any assault, sexual assault that has happened in the past few years on campus. I know that there's been cases of, I'd say, sexual harassment in which students were unable to get certain people away from them, and they would show up in places where it's a very small school. So as you can imagine, you run into the same amount of people a lot most of the time, but there's a difference between running into somebody and then being followed. And so there are plenty of cases of that. I know I actually endured some of that myself. And what the schools, a lot of the school responds with initially a no contact order at my school because it lessens the intensity of the situation that you are unable to talk to your, to the person who's harassing you, and the person who's harassing you is unable to talk to you. And if that, that order is violated, then the school takes more actions against them. I know the school has a lot to, I was looking at FERPA laws. Student records aren't allowed to be released.
And so, what kind of laws?
FERPA. It's federal student privacy laws.
Okay.
And so a lot of times the person who's harassing you, they need to be protected as well in regards to they don't give out details about what is going on with their case for privacy's sake.
And that seems to take us back to what we were just talking about, mm-hmm. about handling the victim versus the supposed criminal, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. The accused person, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today, again, you were just hearing Jalen Windsor, a student at Lynchburg College. We also have Emily Renda. She's on the Governor McAuliffe's new Sexual Assault Task Force, along with Claire Kaplan here today from University of Virginia's Women's Center, where she's Director of Gender Violence and Social Change Program. 1124 here on the Wake Up Call. I'll give out the phone number if somebody has a question or a comment that they choose to make. 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Ladies, anybody who know about, are there federal statistics on where assaults are taking place? Jalen said that she didn't know of anything that had happened in the last few years at Lynchburg College. Mm-hmm. Can we go look that up and see that, sorry, something did take place and the university or the college is just not sharing that information with the students?
So,
the parents?
Yeah, in that case. So what you can do in terms of, there are these things called Cleary reports that are these kind of uniform crime reports that each college is required to release. And those should show the number of kind of official complaints that have been made by students and record the number of incidents that have occurred. So, but that I think the clear distinction is, you know, that usually involves a police report. That usually involves kind of getting campus police or real police involved in order to have that listed as one of the reports made. What we know from statistics many times, and kind of what Claire was speaking to earlier, with a lot of survivors who don't necessarily want to go through those official channels and systems, who aren't ready to deal with that, their cases go unreported, and they don't kind of come across in the numbers because they may be very, very silent. I know kind of from my own personal experience, I'll throw that out to Claire as well. She dealt with me when I was assaulted as a first-year student. I did not report through university systems, and I did not report through police systems. So you would not have seen me as a number that popped up, but I'm still kind of a reality of the climate on campus. And that's really what, kind of to throw back to this idea of federal statistics, what's hoping to happen either through the White House Task Force recommendations, they want climate surveys on college campuses to measure not only incidents, so they would catch the people like me who didn't report through official channels, but then you'd also catch kind of the general attitudes on campus about the way they feel supported or the way that students feel kind of, is it a hostile environment around here? Like, does this happen a lot? Does this happen a little? Get a general sense of the problem on a college campus and have that data and information be publicly accessible and be more informative to parents and incoming students than really these Cleary reports and these official crime reports are right now.
Mm-hmm. And Cleary also gathers reports from unofficial sources. It's listed differently. So they gather them. They always gather them from women's centers. They gather them from other folks who might be the go-to people. It might be someone in student affairs, or it might be someone in a counseling center. They don't get specific details of an assault, but they get a sort of a number, a hatch mark. And now they include intimate partner violence as part of that. That data is available through the Cleary Act website. It's actually a federal thing. Mm-hmm. So anyone can go there and look up an individual school and find the data. But again, as Emily mentioned, and using herself as an example, most students don't report to anyone. In fact, what we've found, whether in national studies and in more specific studies of individual schools, is that the majority of students tell no one. Mm-hmm. And then the next person who might be told is a friend. So this is why it's important for people to know what the resources are, for students to know what the resources are, because it might not be that survivor who knows, remembers anything about resources, but the friend might know.
And Jalen, you mentioned that you found out some information through Claire, not through Lynchburg College.
I did. I would say also this sort of talk is a very important conversation, and a conversation we should all be having a lot more so in these rural areas, especially for some of these colleges that are smaller. And I know me being at a small liberal arts college, these topics need to be discussed in order for us to educate each other in the first place about these resources. And, you know, for people who are in other college, you know, in other colleges down here in Central Virginia, I know that we have Randolph College and Liberty. And these are, you know, some of these universities vary very much so. But the fact is that they still don't have these resources that I would say young individuals need in order to make their voices heard.
Now, not to disagree with Jalen, but she says these schools don't have these resources. Mm-hmm. Is that true, or that they're just not publicizing the resources?
I think, let me clarify.
Okay.
Every school, by title, and in my research, Title IX requires that all schools have a procedure for sexual assault and these sort of situations. So there are resources available for the school. However, support such as the UVA Women's Center and more of the counseling that these people require, I would say that there needs more awareness made just
more,
to that.
More money means that you can build a women's center as opposed to a smaller school, which means that you may not have the funding or allocate the funding to do so.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't necessarily require a women's center. There are institutions that have standalone sexual assault crisis centers. I mean, that's way beyond what we have. But there's also what's important is that they put some resources behind informing students about what the resources are. And sometimes the resources aren't on campus. A lot of students would prefer not to go to the on-campus resources. So in Charlottesville, we have the Sexual Assault Resource Agency and the Shelter for Help and Emergency. And we promote the hotline, and the university actually has a contract with SARA and provides some funding. to Sarah to provide that hotline resource to our students. So that's mm-hmm. another way, especially for small schools, that kind of thing can happen. It is important. I think what Jaylen was talking about, the smaller schools, the small liberal arts schools. If you look at the institutions that are under investigation on that list, the infamous list of bad campuses, there are thousands of colleges and universities in the United States. And I remember seeing a post from my former boss from when I worked at a sexual assault crisis center in L.A., sending a message to her daughter saying, "Thank goodness your school isn't on the list." Well, it's a small, you know, small community college in Central California. And I went to that school's website, and I spent 20 minutes looking for their sexual assault policy, and I never found it. So, you know, and I responded to her. I said, take a look, you know, be a good consumer here. As a parent, she thought that her daughter's school was safe because it wasn't being investigated. And what I'd like to say to parents is, if your child is looking at a school and is investigating schools to attend in the future or currently attending, go to that school's website. How easy is it to find the policies, to find the resources, to find information and education, all those things. And if it takes more than, say, 3 clicks to get there, you need to have second thoughts.
434-979-0919. If you want to bring up a question or make a comment to our guests today, that's Claire Kaplan from University of Virginia's Women's Center, where she's the director of gender violence and the social change program. We have Jaylen Windsor. She's a student at Lynchburg College. We have Emily Renda, recently appointed to Governor McAuliffe's new sexual assault task force. This is WNRN Community Independent Radio here in Charlottesville and Central Virginia. So we were talking about a variety of things. We keep touching on this and that. I want to talk about something that I found doing my homework. And Claire, you said there are a large number of these sorts of associations. The Association for Student Conduct Administration, which apparently is an organization that universities and colleges can turn to for advice in how to handle certain things. And this association has been accused of telling universities not to be punitive mm-hmm. when this sort of incident takes place, a sexual assault takes place, but to treat it more as though as a teaching moment. It's meant to be educational versus criminal. Claire, I see you shaking your head, so we'll start with you. How do you take this? Because you mentioned earlier that the supposed criminal, the accused uh-huh. person who has yet to be proven as being guilty, what do you do in this situation so the pendulum is not completely 100% believable or belief of the victim as soon as that person says anything, and then you turn and start doing things towards a supposed criminal, or I guess we can't use criminal in this case. How do you do this so it's not all crime and partly educational?
It's very hard, and I'm sure Emily and Jaylen will both have something to say about this, but I'm not familiar with that organization, and I'm familiar with others that provide very sound legal and policy advice to institutions. Bottom line is, an institution is supposed to uphold its policies. That is the bottom line. Whatever's in writing, they're supposed to do. You're talking about sanctions, which is the issue of, you know, being punitive or not being punitive. I think what I'm hearing and what in that description is that colleges and universities are educational institutions. I think that this is it points out an interesting tension, because people who serve on these, if there's panels, they're not always panels. Sometimes they're administrative hearings, in which case you may have a dean or a vice president or someone who's hearing the case. At UVA, we have a panel. And it's largely faculty and administrators with student representatives. These are people who are educators. And so there's a tension there. People are trained as educators. They're not judges. They're not lawyers necessarily. Sometimes they are, but they're lawyer. It's professors, you know. And when you work at an institution of higher education, your purpose is to teach, you know. And so the tension there is, we have someone who obviously this is a case when someone's found guilty. So we found someone responsible or guilty for committing this terrible act. Do we say, okay, you're out of here, and release that person onto the world to continue their behavior, because they will not stop, okay, to continue their behavior, or do we keep them roped in and do what we can to make them change? You know, I mean, this is the tension that people have. And so, and anyone who sits on a panel or sits who sat on a jury, a criminal trial, sometimes has that feeling as well of, what do we do with this person? You know, it's not a criminal case. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. You're not going to be putting someone in jail. That's not the job of an institution. The job is to say, are you entitled to stay here or not? And so the question is not only, did the person commit this crime? What would be the consequences if that person stayed here, mm-hmm. for the person who's the victim and for our community both? And they have to weigh those issues. To just blanket say, don't be punitive, I think is misguided.
Emily, so we come back to the list, which I started the conversation with today. We are talking about campus sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Emily Renda is on Governor McAuliffe's Sexual Assault Task Force. And the fact that there are four universities and colleges mm-hmm. in Virginia that made the list, Wayman Mary, JMU, Richmond, and the University of Virginia. One of the comments, and again, if you read the internet, you can find anything you want, and everybody already knows that. But one of the comments that I read in an article was that because the schools on the list need to get off the list, is that you can find people... what's the phrase that I wrote down here? More people can be found guilty to seemingly meet the Title IX compliance. Hmm. I mean, the university's running the trial, and it benefits them, supposedly, tell me that it doesn't, to find someone guilty. If we take the blemish part of the argument away, where they don't want to research it because of the blemish that it might provide, but now they need to report the incident, does it help them to find the person guilty to show that they're doing something about it?
So in many cases, and this is actually becoming quite a problem, and there are several suits that have been filed actually against colleges with accused students who were found responsible and then expelled, kind of alleging like that they were not given the process that is due, that they were kind of – it was inordinately punitive. And that there is this criticism that schools that are under investigation and under a lot of public scrutiny – so, you know, when Huffington Post publishes every sanction that your school gives out – it's lacking in a lot of nuance. And so a lot of schools jump to say, okay, fine, we'll just expel. And so there are a couple things on that that I think are really important to weigh. The first off is that it's very difficult for the public to sometimes see that survivors have very different wishes about what they want to happen to an accused student. And there are plenty of cases in which, and I know this is true for our institution, and it seems to be true of others as well, where students will specifically request that a student not be expelled. And that's, you know, that's something that we really have to weigh. And again, the community safety issue comes up within that. So that's one point. The second point being that a lot of sexual misconduct policies cover a range of conduct and behavior that does not rise to the level of a criminal violation. So there are things that can occur under our sexual misconduct policy that you would be found responsible for that are not rape, that are not.
Can you tell me what those might be?
So there are certain kind of... trying to think of a more specific example, but there are degrees of – it gets kind of technical in court language, but there are degrees of sexual assault that would not really be considered formal sexual assault under a criminal complaint. So there are cases for us that we can do something about that most kind of jurisdictions, most police departments, most DAs, or I guess in our case down here, Commonwealth attorneys, would not pick up those cases because they can't really – meet the level of beyond a reasonable doubt this occurred. And so we can do something to remedy and rectify something that's happened. So kind of non-consensual sexual touching.
Even exposure. Or,
yes.
or taking pictures that someone had taken voluntarily and posted them, sexually suggested pictures and posting them on the internet without their permission, which is not really much of a – it's kind of against the law, but not.
Well, there's a law about that now, right?
Yeah, but you know, here's an interesting thing because I mean, there are cases of students who have had pictures taken. I mean, they then pictures were posted against their wishes, because they specifically said they didn't want their pictures mm-hmm. posted. And then I'm thinking of a case of a person who then was sort of blackmailing these students to come back and take more pictures. The blackmail only involves property, so there was no law against that act. Mm-hmm. I mean, the prosecutor was trying to find a way of charging this person, couldn't do it.
Whereas on college campuses, that's under our policy known as something called sexual exploitation, and we can do something against that student. And so there are degrees to which this broader range of conduct, and Claire really touched on the educational piece of this brilliantly, of, you know, we can take some sort of action against this student. We can mandate counseling. We can do all sorts of educational things to try and correct the student's behavior and the student's misperceptions of clearly how sexual consent should work. And, you know, what is our obligation to say, all right, we have to do something about you, as opposed to just kicking you out? And that really then comes back to the question of, is this person kind of a predator, like a serial predator that we cannot rehabilitate? Or is this somebody that, with a good amount of education and counseling, might be a normal functioning member of society?
11:40 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about campus sexual assault with Emily Renda, Claire Kaplan, and Jalen Windsor.
Price Hyundai on 29 North. From Hyundai, it's the new Veloster, 38 miles per gallon highway, standard BlueLink telematics with hands-free texting. The new Veloster, new thinking for the next generation of drivers. You can find out more at jimpricehyundai.com.
Paragon Day Spa, the down-to-earth spa. Paragon Day Spa offers massage, facials, electrolysis, waxing, and natural nails. Paragon Day Spa takes an all-natural approach where the focus is on you and offers skincare and day spa services. For more information, ParagonDaySpa.com. Paragon Day Spa, 1706 Emmett Street, Charlottesville.
Opera on the James, opening its 10th anniversary season with Puccini's tragic masterpiece La Boheme, on November 9th at the E.C. Glass Civic Auditorium in Lynchburg. La Boheme, starring Camille Zamora as Mimi and Jeffrey Gwaltney as Rodolfo. Tickets and information at operaonthejames.org.
Hi, I'm Katie Falcone from Ashlawn Highland, the home of President James Monroe. Our annual museum open house will take place Sunday, November 16th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., we're offering free house tours and family-friendly activities to local residents from Charlottesville and surrounding counties. From 12 to 4 p.m., visitors will also have the chance to meet Colonel Monroe himself, along with some of his esteemed colleagues. For more information about Ashlawn Highlands Museum Open House or our newly revised house tour, 434-293-8000 or ashlawnhighland.org. I'm Katie Falcone, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today as we talk about campus sexual assault with Jalen Windsor. She's a student at Lynchburg College. We also have Emily Renda, recently appointed to Governor McAuliffe's Sexual Assault Task Force. Claire Kaplan, director of the Gender, Violence, and Social Change Program. During that break, there was conversation about the gap between the universities, what the universities and colleges are doing for these issues, these incidents, the investigations, as opposed to what's going on in the communities, legal systems. Can we jump in and talk about that? Who wants to start?
So I'll just kind of start and say that a lot of kind of why Title IX was extrapolated to then apply to why student sexual misconduct has to be addressed by the universities, because it really just wasn't being picked up by police departments. Kind of DAs or Commonwealth attorneys weren't taking these cases to court. And Claire kind of on the break brought up a really good point of, and as somebody who worked for the Charlottesville Victim Witnesses program, saw a lot of these cases go forward, you'd have rapes prosecuted and you'd have child sexual abuse prosecuted, but it would be kind of stranger rapes, which is not common to college campuses. And, you know, you'd never have a case really between two students that was getting prosecuted because, frankly, they didn't feel that there was enough evidence to move forward. And so I think what is the a little bit of the frustration here is colleges and universities are being expected to kind of wholly remedy this problem that is really kind of community-wide and systemic-wide. And if police could step up and if DAs could step up and take these cases to court and, you know, perhaps even fail sometimes, it would be really important to kind of strengthen our justice response so that it wouldn't matter what schools did because the criminal justice system would have already sorted it out. And so a lot of what we're trying to do on Governor McAuliffe's task force is address the ways in which police can be trained to be more sensitive interviewers so that victims and survivors feel comfortable coming forward. And when they do come forward, they're not discouraged from reporting further. And that kind of DAs and Commonwealth attorneys are encouraged to take these cases and are encouraged to put them to the criminal justice system for that decision to happen. And when once that starts functioning more appropriately and more normally, once we start getting criminal justice responses on a lot of these cases that really, really, really matter for the sake of community justice, we can stop expecting colleges and universities to unilaterally handle this problem they are, frankly, not well equipped to handle.
Well, I think also, you know, Emily brings up a really good point. We're looking at colleges are debating between – or not debating, but they're weighing, you know, the voices of two students who are attending this university who have worked hard to be educated and to work towards a degree. And with those two goals in mind – I think with those two, same two goals in mind, I think that colleges have to weigh those two futures very very carefully, because getting kicked out of college for sexual assault certainly will put a damper on your record.
So, Jalen, a friend of yours comes to you, and the story is that she was assaulted, but she doesn't want to report to anybody. We touched on this very early in the program, in which case significant percentage of time the victim goes to a friend, not to the hospital, not to the police. But she tells you this, and she says, I want to share something with you, but you can't tell anybody else. What do you do?
I mean, my advice to her would be, in order to process this evidence, Emily and Claire were discussing the blind case. I would certainly encourage her to go and at least get the blind case so that she has the capabilities and the accessibility to this, and so that she could process this when she has the time and almost the heart to be able to handle this situation. Also, I would certainly encourage her to seek out the counseling. I know at Lynchburg College and most other universities offer free counseling for their students, and just the ability to go discuss this story, to tell the story to somebody, and have it on record. This is one of the most important things. I know in my own case, in many other cases, documentation is a pertinent part of this. And whenever something occurs or somebody's being harassed or an incident happens, making personal documentation of this and being able to tell what was said, what was seen, are huge parts and huge factors to your story. Being able to tell these details are a huge thing. So what my thoughts to this hypothetical situation is, reassess and try to advocate for the person's personal safety of mind and body.
You know, you were the phrase sensitive interviewers, I believe, and when you were talking about how to help train police to become more sensitive in the interviews of this. I read this, it made me almost gag when I read this, but a short comment that came from a young woman who had been sexually assaulted and had problems in her college system and with the reporting. The student who filed a complaint said that school officials questioned her drinking habits, the length of her dress, and administrators asked if she climaxed during the assault. The school found the accused student responsible for sexual assault and suspended him for a year.
Yeah. Well, that's bad questioning. At the same time, the questions about alcohol, it depends on the context, because sometimes they're trying to ascertain incapacitation. But they can say that. We're trying to figure out how drunk you are, because if you were really drunk, that means you couldn't have consented, and we're trying to figure that out. So that's important and relevant. And students often find, you know, if they're informed about why someone's asking a question, mm-hmm. any person, any survivor, then they feel like they're part of the process and are very willing to and forthcoming about information. The issue of having an orgasm is bad questioning and irrelevant because victims do have orgasms in rape, and males who are assaulted too can have an orgasm when they're being assaulted. This is not an issue of or a measure, so that was clearly a bad question. But the issue of how questions are asked is a real key part of training, whether you mm-hmm. are a person serving on a hearing board or you are an administrator doing an administrative hearing, which usually involves just one or two people in investigating a case, or if you're a law enforcement officer. And you know, speaking specifically to law enforcement, when they're trained to interview suspects. They're not trained to interview victims. And part of the problem is they have to switch gears and apply a totally different approach to talking to people who've been traumatized, and they don't know how. And one thing we're learning and forward-thinking law enforcement agencies and departments mm-hmm. are doing is training their officers, or maybe specific officers, on what trauma does to people's brains, because it changes how you speak about an event and understanding what trauma does to the brain, so that when you're questioning someone and they tell you a different story every time you're asking the question, it doesn't mean they're lying. It means that their brain is completely scrambled from the incident. And they're understanding this more and more, so that that the kinds of things people say and react to when you are asking questions of a survivor is actually in itself evidence of an assault. And they're learning that now. It's not just, you know, the physical injury. It is not just the perk kit. It's what people say and how they communicate the events to you that can be evidence. And that's especially pertinent when it comes to acquaintance sexual assault, which is somewhere around 90% of campus assaults between people who know each other. And there's usually very little evidence, if any at all. And so what matters is what people are saying.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I do recognize that there are men who are sexually assaulted as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that for the conversation today, other than the fact that Claire works at the UVA Women's Resource Center, you can easily replace the gender in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And so please don't accuse me of being gender biased. Again, Emily Renda, Jalen Windsor, and Claire Kaplan here for our conversation today on campus sexual assault. We've talked about teaching the police force on how to do better questioning, and we talked about alerting women to the fact that there are programs available for after the fact. Do we have any programs out there to help men understand what is acceptable behavior, to have men sort of be... what's the phrase that I want, where you hear the story going around about what the guy did, he's bragging mm-hmm. about what happened, and you recognize that that's that's probably over the line? Are there any programs out there to help the other gender in this situation?
Absolutely, absolutely. There are programs all over the country, some really innovative programs that, as people are researching them, because you have to have you have to study them to see if they're actually effective, mm-hmm. are showing evidence of progress. And the most significant shift in prevention work is called bystander intervention. And I would say one of the earliest programs was actually created by a nationally known male activist named Jackson Katz, who's Mentors in Violence Prevention up at Northeastern University. And MVP was one of the very first sort of systematized bystander intervention training programs. It was actually originally aimed at athletes, high school athletes, really, and then it sort of translated to college athletes. And it's now much broader. But that program influenced other programs as well. And there's a number. There's one bringing in the bystander in New Hampshire. There's Green Dot, which is a national organization as well. And what they do is they train everyone, really, should be at a college campus, not just students, but faculty, staff, administrators, the folks serving you food in the cafeteria, whoever it is, on what to look for and how appropriately one can respond, intervene, step in safely in a way that can interrupt a behavior that is one the observer might see as being possibly dangerous and harassing. And what you see is, because most men are not rapists, most men want to do the right thing and are completely at a loss as to what to do, is that this gives, and women too, gives them skills and also a means by which to be an ally. And that is really key. So you feel empowered then to say, hey, you know, dude, that's not okay, you know, and or bring other people in to help.
Well, let me ask you this question, because, again, it's 11:55. We'll never get through all this. So I'm gonna ask a couple quicker questions here, or questions that need quicker responses. As I hear something about being an ally, I also heard this weekend about someone telling men, if you see a woman who's in trouble, who's drunk and alone, don't do this yourself. Call other people to help her.
Yeah.
Because you might become involved in the negative way and being an accused. Is that okay?
Well, I don't know about being accused, but I think it's, yeah, absolutely call other people in. I mean,
it wasn't just call other people in. It's like, don't go over there.
Oh, yeah.
So, and that's like a really common yeah. kind of misconception is that, like, oh, if you ever kiss like a drunk girl, she's just going to wake up and accuse you of rape. And it's really predicated in this awful assumption that women lie about being raped, and women kind of like wake up in the morning, and if they, you know, were touched in a way they didn't really want to be touched, they're just going to cry rape. And so that's, you know, yeah, I have quite a few words for that, but that's kind of an absurd.
Well, now we have the things have gone from the no means no to what's called affirmative consent, where mm-hmm. you have to regularly ask your partner if this is okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, who doesn't want that? I mean, that's good consensual sex. It's a sexual encounter where the two parties are communicating with each other. It can be verbal and nonverbal, and there are ways, kind of clear words and actions you can use to communicate enthusiastic consent in a situation. And that's what a lot of colleges and universities look for in policy violations, is where there are no clear words or actions. And frankly, everyone should want to have good sex, and good sex is communicative, consensual sex.
And I think that's a very good – I think that helps highlight – I mean, it brings an elevation to sex that, especially I think in some of these communities, it's very – it's dealt with as almost an alien matter, and frankly, it's not. And so what I think colleges are trying to do for the better is make sex a positive thing. And so without the negative connotation, it is – I don't want to say easier, but it is students have more access to understand what feels right to them and how that they're being treated well.
And if you can't talk about it, you shouldn't be doing it. I mean, if you can't communicate with your partner, like, does this feel okay? You know, there's a problem. So, you know, we don't talk about sex in this culture, unfortunately.
You know, I mentioned something about men a few minutes ago. Do men who go to file their reports, are they treated in a negative way? They're like, you know, give me a break.
I mean, well, there's a lot of kind of the same responses.
Its own bias against men who are doing this.
It's for men who are coming forward to file a report about something that's happened to them. They face the same exact fears that a lot of female survivors fear, of not being believed, of not being supported, of kind of being re-traumatized by the process. And it is really difficult because they're up against this general assumption that men can't be assaulted and that something's wrong with you if you've been assaulted as a man. And so that's an additional weight that they have coming forward.
We got about 60 seconds left. The number of reports coming forth are increasing. Is that a good thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which shows people are talking about it, that students feel they can come forward.
Because we know it's happening, but it's been happening in these larger numbers, and the fact that the reports are finally starting to reflect what's actually happening is really a positive thing. It means people are getting the support they need.
Can people get in touch with, not necessarily with you directly, Emily, but mm-hmm. can get in touch with the task force to say, this is important for you to look at, this specific topic or concern?
Absolutely.
How do people get in touch with the task force?
So by contacting anyone at the Attorney General's office, there's availability for public comment. All the meetings of the task force are public and open to the public so that people can offer their commentary and their concerns.
We'll see if I can get Mallory to put a link in the podcast for that stress mm-hmm. on Mallory. Again, campus sexual assault. Our guests today, Jalen Windsor from Lynchburg College, Emily Renda on the governor's new sexual assault task force, Claire Kaplan, the director at UVA's Women's Center for Gender Violence and Social Change Program. Ladies, we could have kept going for hours. I really appreciate the three of you coming on today to discuss this. I find it fascinating in such a disturbing manner that I know so little, and I feel like now I know just a touch more, and it makes me hungry to learn more about the topic and what I can do to help. So I hope you'll come back in the future and we can do another show on this.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
All right, Les Temps-Perdue up next. Next week, Professor Sidney Milkus will be on the program. We're going to talk about historical but often overlooked elections and how they have helped change history.
This has been your Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WNRN. The Wake-Up Call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong
and Max Cecilia Struther.
Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.